in a company, it's totally okay for the owner to say, well, if you don't want to support our mission, I don't need to support you, and you know the deal is off, so to speak. So you can be fired. You can't be fired from society. I mean, you can be exterminated, and that's what some of these ruthless and evil leaders do, saying, well, you're not a part, you don't, if you're not committed to the transcendent goal of our race, we're going to get rid of you because you're a traitor to the people, or you're from an inferior race, and so on. And then, well, and I don't have to go into details of how much horror that has created it historically. Mm-hmm. So I believe that the role of a society, or the mission of a society, is to become a platform in which individuals can pursue their individual goals and life purposes with peace and with mutual respect. And I emphasize this because your freedom ends where mine starts. So you know, you're free to use your property, and you're free to pursue your life ambition, but with some boundaries based on the need to coexist. You can't say, oh, to pursue my life ambition, I like your car, so I'm going to take it. That's the dissolution of society. So there, that's what I mean by an institutional structure that harnesses the individual's desires for self-improvement or the improvement of their condition in a way that doesn't harm through coercion or aggression or violence the opportunities of other members of the society to also pursue their ambitions. And that's a very important structure that underlies every successful society.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Fred, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I was actually introduced to you by way of your publisher, who sent me a copy of your book, The Meaning Revolution, and I was really blown away by it. I sat down and tore through it in about 2 or 3 days. But before we get into the content of the book, I would want to start by asking you, what was the very first way that you ever made money growing up?
I was a youth leader. I'm Jewish, and in the Jewish community, we have a term called Madrich. So I was, when I was 12, I started working with kids that were 6 to 8 years old.
Mm-hmm. And what impact did that end up having on your life and sort of the direction that things have gone for you?
I'm still doing the same. I mean, now I do it with kids that are 46 to 48 years old. Uh-huh. But really, I feel like I'm still, I'm an executive coach, I'm a teacher, I'm an advisor, and I feel that really my life path has been going first and trying to make all the mistakes that are possible and learning from them and paying the price so I then can ease the path of other people that don't have to learn from their own experience, but they can use my sometimes wonderful, sometimes terrible experiences to avoid some of the pitfalls that I found.
Mm-hmm. So talk me through how you get from being a youth leader to being an economist who was trained at Berkeley, which we share that in common. I was a Berkeley undergrad, to mm-hmm. how you get to doing leadership at LinkedIn, because that doesn't seem like a straight and narrow path.
Oh, no, my life has been anything but straight and narrow. I was interested in the human condition and how human beings develop because I was perhaps beginning with me, wondering what does it mean to live a good life, to grow up, to be a a healthy and, I would say, brilliant human being. And it was a really interesting exploration, because it kept getting deeper and deeper and deeper. And every time I thought, okay, this is it, then I would say, oh, but there's more. And I ended up believing, which is my current belief, that the path is infinite, that there is no stopping point to how extraordinary and beautiful a human life can be. And also there's no limit to how horrible and how hellish a human life can be for oneself and to others, as you know, some of the monstrous bad leaders in history demonstrate. So I wanted to study something that would combine the psychological, humanistic, spiritual, philosophical dimensions with something more precise and rigorous. I always had a good head, so to speak, a brain that was suitable for mathematics and for abstraction and rigorous logical thinking. And it seemed, well, economics was an obvious thing to do. I studied originally in Argentina. Mm-hmm. And seeing the disastrous way in which the economy has always been mismanaged there, I was curious, like, how can this be? This country has all these great assets, you know, natural resources, fairly educated people, and yet it is such a mess that the contradiction or the non-linearity, that the fact that you have all the components that are very good, but then the system works very bad. What's wrong here? Where are we breaking the chain that goes from each one of these good components to the bad system? And I tried to understand that. I studied economics, and after 5 years, I didn't know anything. I didn't feel like I could understand anything. So I went to Berkeley and I studied economics there. And I had to make a choice between the human part and the rigorous mathematical part. And to be honest, I was a bit sick about the human part, because I lived through some really hard times in Argentina. I lived through a coup and a military government and some really hard things related to people disappearing and a lot of violence. It wasn't overt violence, but it was very frightening covert violence. So I decided to just focus on the theory and do mathematics. And that's what I did. I ended up teaching at MIT. Information systems and very, you know, very technical things. But I discovered that the real problems companies have, MIT has a wonderful connection with industry. So I had many chances to work with companies. And the discovery was that the problems that companies have are not really technical. I mean, certainly they need a certain amount of knowledge, the technical engineering stuff, but that's not where I thought the biggest difference could be made. It was really people not working well together. And in a sense, that discovery helped me also go back to the Argentinian economic situation and realize it wasn't the lack of knowledge. It was just that people didn't work well together. There was no trust. There were no connections, no alignment in terms of basic institutional rules that would allow a group of people to work together for the common good. And I started realizing that perhaps the solution to the problems that have been plaguing me since my early studies was not in more abstract mathematical models or theories, but really understanding how human beings think and work together. And that's what I started doing. I quit MIT after 6 years. I became a consultant, and I started working with technically minded people on humanistic issues, because my background and my my earlier studies gave me enough of a, I'd say, an identity to be able to speak about love, as I say, the four-letter word, without being immediately tarred, feathered, and kicked out of the company. So that's what I've been doing for the last 30 years, and that's the path that brought me to MIT, to LinkedIn, from MIT to LinkedIn, and then from LinkedIn to Google, where I'm currently an advisor for leadership development.
You know, what lessons from history, particularly economic history, do you think that we haven't learned that are impacting our society today?
I'd say there's the biggest lesson. I don't know if we haven't learned, but I'll say just the lesson that I had not learned, and I feel that by learning that lesson, a lot of things became clear to me. It's something that in economics is called the fallacy of composition. And the fallacy of composition would say that if you focus on each part and you add up the parts or you aggregate the parts in a linear way, you're going to get the whole. And that is wrong, at least in nonlinear systems, like, you know, any system that we're interested in, and certainly an economy or a company. When you look at the individual components, you miss something very essential about the system. So the way I would say this, with using a mathematical expression, is that in order to optimize the system, in order to do the best for the system, you cannot optimize the subsystems. You have to avoid optimizing the subsystems. In fact, you have to sub-optimize the subsystems. What that means is that if you want to do the best for the team, every player has to subordinate to the team objective. You cannot have people trying to do the best for themselves, because that destroys the team's ability to perform as a unit. So a good team is not necessarily made of the best individuals. A good team is made of individuals that play well together. And even though each one of them may not be at the top of the game, so to speak, the team as a whole will perform much better than other teams that may have individually better players. This is called the fallacy of composition, and it applies to a lot of issues in economics. So if I look at a national economy, for example, and I would say if people are so self-interested and driven by their own objectives, that they're willing to harm with their behavior the welfare of other people, and there's no institutional structure to avoid that harm, then the economy will collapse. And we definitely haven't learned this lesson. I'm really distressed by seeing the state of the world and each economy, and how we don't have a clear system that will prevent, I would say, greed. You know, greed, as opposed to Gordon Gekko's famous statement in Wall Street, greed is not good. Greed is rapacious. It's not an ambition to do well. Greed is overstepping boundaries to take advantage of other people for personal benefit. And there's always this idea that, oh, I can get a quick gain and avoid paying some price, and then I'll be better off, and I'm going to sock someone else with the bill. And that is the death knell of any society. I've seen this happen in Argentina. Now we can all see it happening in slow motion in Venezuela, how it's been collapsing for several years, to the point that now it's a humanitarian disaster. People are refugees are exiting en masse from Venezuela, trying to go to all the other countries in South America. It's just, and why did this happen? Because there were promises, oh, you can get something for nothing. The government will give you something, and the government will make this out of just thin air, as opposed to, we're going to take it from the rich. And it's not fair that some people have a lot and some people don't. So we're going to take from the ones who have to give to the ones that don't have, as a matter of social justice. And, this is not speaking about the need for justice, but the greed or the desire to get something for nothing and the belief that it's possible to avoid the work that it takes to produce a result, and that the system will work better by having some individuals take advantage of others, that always ends badly.
Do you think that we're in danger of that happening here in the United States?
Oh, absolutely. There's so many political tensions. I hesitate to have any opinions about the United States. I'm very humble about it. It's a very complex system. I've been blessed to come to this country as an immigrant and be received with such open arms. My life has been really blessed by the opportunities that I encounter in the United States. I am an absolute fan and lover of the core ideas that founded this nation. So I feel almost more American than if I had been born here. But at the same time, I'm still tentative about understanding this society and what are the stresses that are beginning to fracture it. And I see more and more that there are divisions in terms of political thinking that are taking people to extremes in their camps. And there are very few people that are thinking, how do we create a system that will be just and will respect the individual rights that created this republic in a way that create prosperity and peace with mutual respect? I see that there are very few voices that in the cacophony of political extremism will call for this higher order consideration and ask, how do we all live together? Not how do we get, or how does this party or that party get away with some of its political agenda? So I'm seeing this, and I'm worried. I wouldn't say I'm frightened at this point, but I'm worried that I've seen the political tensions get to the point where they become violent. And we have a saying in Argentina, it doesn't translate too well, but it says something like, when you get burned by hot milk, if you get burned by hot milk, every time you see a cow, you start crying. I gotten burned because I've been in the middle of some really bad political extremes between terrorism and anti-terrorism and coups and disappearances and so on. So maybe I'm oversensitive or a little paranoid, but I'm beginning to smell the whiffs of misunderstandings and lack of dialogue that can, well, at least in my experience, led originally to some bad, very, very bad outcomes.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the consequences for the species or humanity at large are for what is going on here long term?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I would say we are at the crossroads because we've gotten to a technological state in which almost anybody can exterminate everybody. there are too many ways in which we can create harm for one another. And some of these are really existential risks to humanity. So if we learn how to live together in love and respect, I can see an extraordinarily amazing future that unfolds before us. If we don't, I question whether we're going to make it, or you know, it's going to be the cockroaches, the ones that that really rule the earth. So, I'm kind of a defensive pessimist. What I mean is, I try to think what's the worst thing that can happen, and then act very energetically to avoid it and to make sure it doesn't happen. So I think if humanity is able, if we are all able to learn our lesson on how to coexist in peace and respect, it's an amazing opportunity to grow and get to some extraordinary levels of consciousness and development and prosperity if we don't, it doesn't look too good.
Well, I think that makes really a perfect segue to talk about the content of the book. You know, you talk about this idea of transcendent relationship leadership. What is the role of transcendent leadership, not just in our companies, but in society at large? Because it seems from everything you've just told me, this extends far beyond the walls of a company.
Yes. It does, and yet there's a fundamental difference between a company and society. And I think that, again, there's a fallacy of composition when people go from a company to society or humanity or, you know, a larger group. And let me try to explain, because this is not in the book, but it's a very, for me at least, it's a very significant difference. A company has a purpose. A company is an entity that's created by human beings that get together to accomplish something they couldn't accomplish alone. So let's just say I can start a company alone, but then I'll get employees or I get other engaged consultants or other resources to participate in my company to accomplish something I couldn't do alone. Most often and naturally, people will get together with co-founders, and then they'll raise capital, and they'll have investors, and then the company will become, if it's successful, it may become public, and then a lot of people invest in it. But there's always a guiding idea and a mission that the company has set out for itself. In society, that is not the case. We don't have a common purpose necessarily, in the sense that we're trying to achieve something like a company does. So if you take, say, Google, for example, it's a company that has a purpose and products and a market, and it's trying to accomplish something, and it has a strategy, and it has employees. And when Google hires someone, Google says, look, we want your help to accomplish our mission. If you're willing to support us, we're willing to pay you. We're willing to support you in exchange. So there's a trade, so to speak, in which you give us your best effort to support our mission, and we'll help you grow, we'll help you be prosperous, we'll help you support your family, you know, whatever you want. And we'll give you a good working environment so you can be happy and healthy and so on. That's the trade. Society is not like that. You're born in a society, and there's no purpose. The society doesn't have a mission. In fact, I'm pretty scared of the people that says a society has a mission. That's usually fascism or communism or kind of more statist ideologies that will start violating the rights of the individual for the sake of the individual participating in the society and being part of the group. That's typical of fascism and Nazism and any form of, as I said before, communism. So in a company, it's totally okay for the owner to say, well, if you don't want to support our mission, I don't need to to support you, and you know the deal is off, so to speak. So you can be fired. You can't be fired from society. I mean, you can be exterminated, and that's what some of these ruthless and evil leaders do, saying, "Well, you're not a part. You don't. If you're not committed to the transcendent goal of our race, we're going to get rid of you because you're a traitor to the people, or you're from an inferior race, and so on." And then, well, and I don't have to go into details of how much horror that has created it historically. Mm-hmm. So I believe that the role of a society, or the mission of a society, is to become a platform in which individuals can pursue their individual goals and life purposes with peace and with mutual respect. And I emphasize this because your freedom ends where mine starts. So you know, you're free to use your property, and you're free to pursue your life ambition, but with some boundaries based on the need to coexist. You can't say, "Oh, to pursue my life ambition, I like your car, so I'm going to take it." That's the dissolution of society. So there, that's what I mean by an institutional structure that harnesses the individual's desires for self-improvement or the improvement of their condition in a way that doesn't harm through coercion or aggression or violence the opportunities of other members of the society to also pursue their ambitions. And that's a very important structure that underlies every successful society. But the success in society is the success of the individuals of society. There's no entity called society that has a purpose of its own. Every time someone wants to speak for the people, it usually becomes a tyrant that ends up leaving a lot of dead bodies in its wake.
So it's possible that you probably don't give much thought to the cleaning products that you use, whether it's dishwashing liquid, laundry detergent, or spray-on cleaner. If you're like me, you probably just picked up whatever was on the shelf that could get the job done. Well, it turns out that most of the household cleaning products and personal care products that we use are filled with toxic chemicals that can be really harmful, not just for our environment, but for our health as well. And that's why I'm really excited about the fact that Grove.co decided to sponsor the podcast. They're on a mission to help every family create and sustain a healthy, beautiful home, which aligns with our mission to help improve the quality of your personal and professional life. Remember that as unmistakable creative guest Jim Bunch once said, everything that you see, hear, smell, taste, and touch is an environment that has an impact on your life, and that includes the products you use to clean and take care of yourself. I've been using the Myers cleaners to wipe down my desk every night before I go to sleep. Not only does this stuff smell amazing, but I wake up in a very zen-like, focused state of mind because my desk is spotless. In addition to selling eco-friendly, non-toxic products, which are vetted to be the best all-natural products around, you get a personal concierge, which is crazy for a company that sells cleaning and personal care products, and they price match, so you know you're getting the best price. For a limited time, Unmistakable Creative listeners who sign up get an amazing $30 Myers gift set, a free 60-day VIP membership, and a bonus gift for you when you sign up and place an order of $20 or more. So check out grove.co/creative for their special offer. When you buy from Grove.co, you're not just supporting the Unmistakable Creative, you're supporting the planet. And that's what I call conscious capitalism. So you say in the book that the meaning revolution explores a paradigm shift from matter to meaning, from compensation, command, and control to purpose, principle, and people, from management to leadership. And I think when I read the first half of the book, it seemed like you addressed what are effectively the challenges that every organization faces, which are disengagement, disinformation, disorganization, and power. Do you mind expanding on what those challenges are and the impact that they have on a company? And then we can go into how we solve those issues.
Sure. Well, I like to use the metaphor or an analogy I use in the book because it's very graphic. The first challenge, which I call disorganization, is illustrated by the challenge that a soccer team would face if we looked at it from the individual point of view. So if you go to a defensive player and you ask any defensive player, what's your job? Well, the defensive player would say, well, to stop goals. That's what I get paid to do. That's how I'm evaluated. That's my KPI or my key performance indicator. That's what my coach asked me to do. I'm here to protect the goal. That's my job. And if you ask an offensive player, they say, my job is to score goals. That's what I'm being evaluated on. That's what I get paid to do. That's what the coach asks me to do. And that's what I'm here for. Nobody would disagree with that. I mean, I challenge you and your listeners to go to any company, or if they work in a company, to ask their peers, you know, what's your job? What do you do here? And the question will always be something specific, like I'm in accounting, or I'm a marketing manager, or I do customer service calls, or I'm in sales. Okay, that's wrong. The challenge of every company is that all those answers, as obvious as they seem, are wrong. And you know, that the first time I thought about it, I was completely flabbergasted by realizing something so obvious was a mistake, because I was sure I would answer the same thing. And the reason why this is a mistake is because in order to optimize the system, you have to sub-optimize the subsystems. The job of a defensive player is the same job as the one of an offensive player, is the same job as one of the coach, and it's the same job as one of the one of the water boy. And the job of every person that is affiliated to the team is to help the team win. That's the only job. That's the only reason why people are there, to help the team win. Now, people may have different roles and organize themselves to help the team win most effectively, but it's a putting the cart before the horse to say, my job is to be a defensive player. No, your job is to help the team win. You do it most often defending, but your job is to help the team win, not to defend. And you may wonder, well, why does this matter? What difference does this make? Well, it makes a huge difference, because if you think your job is to defend when you're losing 1-0 and there's 5 minutes to go, the coach will ask you to go and attack, to go and try to help the offensive line score. And you're going to say, oh, no, that's not my job. I'm not here to score goals. I'm here to protect the goal. And in fact, if I go forward and I try to score another goal, I may get scored against in a counterattack, because I'm going to leave my position and protect it by going forward. So if you really are trying to minimize the chances that you will be scored against, you should stay back. You should not go forward and try to score. That would be a very bad strategy for the team, because from the point of view of the team, whether you lose 1-0 or 2-0 is irrelevant. Your KPI may be affected, your bonus may be affected, because now, you know, instead of one goal against, you know, you have two goals scored against you. But the truth is, it doesn't matter. You still lose. Losing 1-0, losing 2-0 is still a loss. Whereas losing 1-0 or tying 1-1 makes a huge difference to the team. So the key realization that I had was, most people in companies are focused on doing what they feel they get paid to do, what they believe is going to optimize their subsystem. But when you put all these optimized subsystems together, you don't get an optimized system, you get a mess. And that's what I call disorganization. And another analogy I use is less funny, but it's the analogy of cancer, because the cancerous cells are extremely successful. They're reproducing and gaining power and energy and space and nutrients and all that, and they keep growing until the body dies. Now, you could say the person lost, but the cancer, it's a Pyrrhic victory, but the cancer won because it became so big that it just could be controlled by the rest of the organism. And the cancer is essentially cells that are growing out of line with the global welfare of the body. So you could say that can also happen in society when a group says we're going to take, I don't know, say a mafia group that says we're going to keep, you know, squeezing the people in this neighborhood, and we have a protection racket. We're going to take money and more money until, you know, everybody leaves or dies because they can't pay the extortion. That doesn't mean they were not successful, but they being successful in a way that destroys the system at the end is self-defeating. And I see this happening in companies all the time. And people don't realize that they're having fights because each one of them is trying to solve for their problem. So the salesperson wants to sell more, the product person wants to be innovative, the engineering person wants to be efficient and elegant, the manufacturing person wants to minimize costs, and nobody's thinking about the system. Each person is doing the best for their sub-organization, but the goal of the company is not to maximize revenue, is not to minimize cost, is not to maximize speed. The goal of the company is to fulfill its mission effectively and ethically. And as long as people are not understanding that that's their job, that's the only job they have, it won't happen.
Wow. Well, I guess the question then that poses is, what are the solutions to all of this? I know that you talk about the role of autonomy, purpose, and mastery, motivation. Yes. So how do we get from where you're talking about the sort of toxic consequences to the ones that ultimately allow both the individual and the organization to thrive?
Yes, great question. Well, before I give you the good answer, I'll tell you the bad answer that I spent years exploring. As I said, you know, my goal is to help people not go through into the cul-de-sacs that I've ended up finding myself. You could say, well, why don't we compensate everybody for the success of the team? That seems like an obvious way to solve the problem. You know, if you want to optimize the system, then compensate everybody through the performance of the system as a whole. In a soccer team, that would mean, well, you know, if we win, everybody wins, and if we lose, nobody gets bonus or something like that. In a company, let's just say if you have a sales force, you can tell all there's a sales commission pool, and 10% of whatever everybody sells goes into this pool, and then it's divided equally between all the people. And that makes perfect sense from a mathematical standpoint because it solves the optimization problem. The issue with that is that human beings are self-interested and they have private information, meaning I know how hard I'm working, and you can't tell really how hard. You can see what I do with my body perhaps through external observation, but nobody can tell, am I thinking really hard? Am I being as creative as I can be? Am I pushing myself? Am I exploring all the options? Am I being scared about things, or am I being lazy about other things? You don't know. Nobody can know, because these are internal experiences that are impossible to observe from an external perspective. And the problem that creates is that people become very strategic about the way they game the system. And you have the same problem essentially that the communist system will have, because you create a pool that you say, well, everybody's going to get average. But you have two significant problems there. The first is that average pay, as I say in the book, drives the best ones away. So if you have, you know, a superstar salesperson that's at the top end of the distribution, he or she is not going to want to get average pay, because they can get 3 times average pay or 10 times average pay. So if you say we pay average to all our salespeople, you're going to get the worst people, because anybody that's above average is not going to want to be there. So your average is going to go down. And again, everybody's going to try to be riding the coattails of those who are better than them to increase their compensation. And anybody who feels they're being taken advantage because they feel they're above the average of that organization, it's going to look for greener pastures. That's a very bad outcome. In economics, we call that adverse selection. You're selecting the worst people. And the other problem is called moral hazard. And this, you know, if there's 1,000 salespeople, your impact in your compensation is 1/1,000. So you're not going to work that hard because you know that your compensation depends on how hard the other 999 people work. So then everybody ends up focusing much more on what other people do and yelling and complaining and fighting and demanding other people and claiming that they haven't been treated justly or that they work harder than everybody else. And these two problems, moral hazard and adverse selection, have essentially brought down the Berlin Wall and also modernized China, because the very communist regimes that attempted to run a society with equality realized that the price to pay for this equality is total collapse. And the same thing happens in companies. There are very few companies that will implement these collectivist schemes and last very long. Because this is not because people are evil. This is just the way humans are. If we were angels, the attempt to have everybody contribute according to his means and take and receive or collect according to his needs would be lovely. It's a very lofty objective for a social organization, but it just doesn't work with real human beings. Mm-hmm. And it ends up always creating chaos and violence. So how do we solve this problem? If we can't do individual incentives and we can't do collective incentives, you know, what the hell do we do? This is the problem that led me to write the book. I've been struggling with this problem for 30 years. It really seems like a no-win situation. And as Einstein said, you know, we can't solve the problems we've created in the same level of thinking that created the problem. We have to think at a higher level. And that's when I realized we can't address these problems just with mathematics. We can't just look for a clever incentive system. There's something else that human beings have, which are desires for transcendence, desires to have a life of meaning, a life of community and belonging, a life with love, a life with autonomy, to explore oneself and develop one's capacities. And all these things, you can't buy this. There's no money to pay for this. This is something that you offer as a platform for people to develop. You can't give people autonomy. You can't give people community, and you can't give people meaning, but you can create the conditions in which people find them, in which people can develop them together and individually. And that's the solution that I found, is a set of incentives that is not monetary, but it's spiritual. You can call it that way. Understanding spirit as an animating force, as something that drives people to want to do the best. Not because they're being just paid to do the best, but because it's the right thing to do, because it's ethical, because it's conducive to making for themselves a life that is relevant, that will leave a mark, that will not be forgotten. And I know, I mean, first by introspection and then by talking to many people, that ultimately our fear is that our lives won't matter, that we will just be this proverbial spark in eternity, a blink of an eye, and then we'll be gone and nobody will remember us and our life will have made no difference. So we all want to participate in projects that will give us a chance to avoid that very sad fate and do something that will help others, that will touch others, that will improve their lives, that will leave a legacy, that will allow us to say, my life really mattered. And not just to me, not just because I had a lot of pleasure, but because I did something that was important. Today, so many of the incentive systems in companies are designed towards pleasure and what I call frivolous happiness. that, you know, it's, I'm not against enjoying a good movie or having a margarita at the beach, but ultimately that doesn't really fill you up. I mean, it doesn't fill me up. I can have one, but by the time you have your 10th margarita at the beach, it's not enjoyable anymore. And when you spend a month relaxing at the beach and just watching the sunset, that was beautiful the first day, it kind of gets boring, and you say, okay, what am I going to do? And you get restless because you know that there's something more that you were born to do than to watch sunsets and sip margaritas, no matter how beautiful the landscape is. And then you want to do something. You want to make something happen because you know intrinsically that that's the purpose of your life. And you are going to give your life whatever purpose is suitable to your unique signature, or you can call it your soul print or whatever, but there's something that you were born to do, and you have to find what it is and then actually pursue it. And if you don't, you will end up miserable. So leading in a way that gives people the opportunity to realize that soul print, to manifest their unique signature in this world in service of others, is the ultimate non-monetary contract, and it's the ultimate incentive. So a leader says, look, I'll give you the chance to participate in this project that will not only give you financial security and, you know, the material things you need to satisfy your needs, but more importantly, will give you a chance to make your life great, to grow in autonomy, in wisdom, in compassion, in cooperation with others, and make something that will touch a lot of people now and maybe for many years to come. I don't know, because I want to cure cancer. You know, that may not be the most financially rewarding career for them. But there are a lot of people that are passionate about that and would love to work in companies that have that mission. And you know, then you don't have to worry about these collective versus individual incentives, because people are so committed to the mission that brings them together that they won't prey upon each other. They won't be opportunistic in taking advantage of an incentive system because they feel identified. It's part of them. They have internalized the mission of the group to make it a mission of their own. And that's the ultimate solution. And that's what I'm trying to advocate with the book. Leadership, or transcendent leadership, is this kind of invitation that gets people fired up with this sacred fire. And they want to collaborate. They want to participate in a project that's beautiful and ethical, because it's in service of the rest. That's what I like about the market system, because it's an opt-out or opt-in system. You better develop products that make other people's lives better, because if not, people won't buy them. Of course, you can tweak the system. You can prey upon people's vulnerabilities with vices and substances that are addictive or advertisement that fools them into making decisions that ultimately they'll regret. That's one of the dangers of any system. But at best, when people are in organizations that are mindful, that are willing to improve other people's lives, then it's just the most beautiful endeavor that I can imagine.
Wow. So I have two final questions for you. I know we've got about 10 minutes left here. You talk about this idea of conscious capitalism, and I had to ask about that because, you know, on the one side you have conscious capitalism, and then you have things, you know, that people like Noam Chomsky are talking about, the fact that when you have such inequality in a society, the systemic consequences are catastrophic. How do those two things coexist?
Well, I would say I don't disagree with Chomsky. So let me start there. I do believe that with certain levels of inequality, things become catastrophic. The question is, what system is best to avoid this, I would say, extreme inequality, and how much inequality is still acceptable within a system? I personally don't want to focus on inequality. I want to focus on ethics and morality, because I mean, maybe I'm naive, but I believe absolutely that when people abide by very basic ethical rules of interaction, there's a natural level of inequality that ensues that has to do with the inequality of our nature. Like I don't know, if I take it to basketball, for example, you know, I will never be able to play at an equality level with a professional NBA player. There's just no way. I don't have the equipment. Or in singing, I can't sing like Freddie Mercury or Barbara Streisand. I'll never do it, no matter how much I try. And if I say, oh, but there's a certain, we have to be equal. Now, why should they have the opportunity to perform in these big venues and not me, and so on? That's just wrong. I mean, it's envy, it's jealousy, it's the greed for the unearned. You know, I don't deserve it. And just the same, I mean, I know it's a little hotter, but if I go into academic realms, sometimes when I tell my students, we're going to do a great redistribution scheme. So it would be catastrophic that some students get A's and some students fail. That's terrible. You know, that's not fair. We all need to focus on creating, diminishing the inequality. So we're going to take, we're going to take the average, and then everybody's going to be graded at average. And the students that did better in the test are going to be taxed, and the points of these students will be given to the ones that did worse. So that way we don't have this terrible difference between the best students and the worst performing students. And of course, there's an uproar, and the students, I mean, they start complaining, and you know, in a joking manner, because they know I'm not serious about it. I couldn't do something like this. And I think in society, there's something similar about what is the ethical principles through which we want to reduce the inequalities, but in a way that still respect the natural differences in talents and also in effort. Some people want to, you know, give themselves to a certain task, and some people don't. Some people want to work less, or want to work, in something that brings more joy to their heart. So measuring this only economically seems rather poor to me. What I'm against is violence. What I'm against is force applied to pursue some allegedly ultimate goal that will justify the abuse of the individuals and doing things to them that ultimately destroy them. So I think, like Adam Smith, that when every individual pursues their own interest in a legitimate way that guarantees the coexistence, the peaceful coexistence in society, then that will bring the best outcome with the minimum reasonable or natural level of inequality in society. Another question with which I challenge my students is to say, imagine that you could double the income of everybody today in the United States, just double the income of everybody in real terms, not just inflation, but real doubling of income. Would you take that? And of course, most people, I think, would be uncontroversial to say yes. I mean, why would we not want everybody to be better off? But that would significantly decrease the index, meaning make it more unequal. It would double the level of inequality, depending on how you measure it. And you say, well, if you're focused on inequality, then you should not accept this. You would want the poor to remain as poor as they are instead of doubling their income, just because you don't want the rich to have twice as much. And I say, why do you care? I mean, why does that matter to you? let the rich be rich. Okay. I mean, of course, if they earned or they made their money in unfair way or criminal ways, of course I'm against it. But I'm against it because it's ethical to not condemn these people for what they've done, not because they're rich. If someone is rich and they became rich legitimately through choice and through contributing to the lives of others, what do I care if they have all the money in the world? The more, the better. I mean, I don't. It doesn't matter to me. I'd like everybody to have a good life. So the conscious capitalism idea is, if you can do this unconsciously, as Adam Smith said, just let everybody pursue their own self-interest in a, as I said, in a legitimate way, and then society will be better. How much better society could be if people wanted to help others on purpose, consciously, not being unconscious capitalists, but being conscious. So, when Larry and Sergey founded Google, they had this great principle: is first do no evil. And it's really powerful to say we're here to organize the world's information to make people more productive. Or, you know, if you look at LinkedIn's mission, I have the honor of being friends with Reid Hoffman, and just incredibly inspiring mission to connect the world professionals to make them more productive and successful. I feel proud to do that. And not just because we make money with that, but I feel proud, both LinkedIn and Google, I feel proud to be part of organizations that are helping people live better lives and making the world more, friendly or more connected, more open, more available, more resourceful. That's conscious. In addition to the money we make, and in addition to the compensation I get as an employee of these companies, I feel I'm getting a huge payoff or a huge extra bonus for being a member in a project that it certainly is leaving a mark in humanity.
Well, I think that makes a really fitting end to our conversation. So I want to ask you one last question, which is how we finish all of our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Unmistakable. Tell me more about unmistakable. Unmistakable, like they would not be mistaken with someone else, or they will be not ever making a mistake.
I think the former rather than the latter. That's actually how I define it.
Yeah, unmistakable meaning people will know you are you, and you would be unique, differentiated.
Exactly.
I think what makes each one of us unmistakable is that we are a unique... I hesitate, but probably this is my truth because I hesitate to say it. It's a little too out there, but I'll say it's that we are, each one of us is a facet of an infinitely faceted diamond. You can call it consciousness, you can call it what is, you can call it the universe, you can call it life, or you can call it God, whatever word you want to use, or it, or that which is. It's an infinitely faceted diamond. And each one of us is a unique expression of that. So everybody's unmistakable in his or her essence. The question is translating that unmistakable individual divine essence into a manifestation in this reality, into a life well lived, into a true following of what the Indian tradition calls your dharma, which is your duty, your truth, your essence, your expression. So what makes someone unmistakable, in my view, is that they have recognized themselves as a true and unique expression of the dharma, of the divine infinite energy, and then they live their life accordingly to express it.
Well, I think that makes a really beautiful end to our conversation. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and the book?
The book is called The Meaning Revolution, and you can find it in Amazon. I think that's the obvious place to learn more about it. But I am on LinkedIn, Fred Kaufman, K-O-F-M-A-N. And I put there a whole, 100 short videos of 5 minutes or so with the course that I created for LinkedIn on leadership. And it's freely available to everybody. There are summaries of the book and all sorts of things. So if people just go to my profile and look for the publications that I put there in LinkedIn, it's the easiest way to find
me. Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.